HPPodCraft.com.
Haunted, you said? Yes, haunted. Don't you remember, when I saw you 3 years ago, you told me about your place in the West, with the ancient woods hanging all about it, and the wild domed hills and the ragged land? It has always remained a sort of enchanted picture in my mind as I sit at my desk and hear the traffic rattling in the street in the midst of whirling London. But when did you come up? The fact is, Dyson, I've only just got out of the train. I drove to the station early this morning and caught the 10:45. Well, I'm very glad you looked in on me. How have you been getting on since we last met? There's no Mrs. Vaughn, I suppose.
That is the opening to Arthur Macken's The Shining Pyramid. Not the rom-com I was anticipating, but a spooky, otherworldly sachet into the weird. Category is Fairy Eleganza.
Who was that reader?
That is George Woodruff. He is a talented voice actor. He's available for all your voiceover needs, audiobooks, commercials, you name it, he can do it.
He of Black Destroyer fame, George Woodruff. Glad to have him back. We'll link out to George in the show notes, and if you click the link, it gives him a little tickle.
Yeah.
That's how the internet works, according to me.
He loves it.
By the way, I'm Chad Pfeiffer. Hello.
Oh, and I am Chris Lackey, and we're here on Strange Studies, The Strange Stories. It's Fairy Bember. And we're doing fairy stories this month.
This month is, of course, brought to you by Sprite. Never accept food in fairyland, but here in the human realm, it's drink Sprite or be punished.
I thought having to drink Sprite was punishment enough.
Well, you know their slogan, Sprite. Sorry, it's all we have.
Apologies, we're not 7-Up. This story, The Shining Pyramid, was first published in 1895.
Right, it was published in Unknown World and then slightly revised by the author for the 1925 collection, The Shining Pyramid. I think it's the revised version that we're reading. Something else happened in 1895 that I was reading about in the Paris Review. You've probably already read this because I know you hit the Paris Review first thing over breakfast every morning. But I'm going to go ahead and read this selection from it. In 1895, the editors of a new magazine, The Unicorn, sought to make a splash by engaging a pair of literary hot properties to contribute parallel series of tales. The two writers were Arthur Macken and H.G. Wells, both fresh off recent publishing triumphs. In Macken's case, perhaps scandal is closer to the mark. That's a reference to Great God Pan. And their contributions were to offer readers distinct modes or flavors of what we today would call genre fiction. The magazine unfortunately folded after a mere 3 issues, in which only one of Wells' stories and none of Macken's appeared. Macken related the episode nearly 3 decades later in characteristically self-deprecating fashion. The Great God Pan had made a storm in a Tiny Tot's teacup. At about the same time, a young gentleman named H.G. Wells had made a very real and a most deserved sensation with a book called The Time Machine. A book indeed. And a new weekly paper was projected by Mr. Ravenhill and Mr. Girdlestone, a paper that was to be called The Unicorn, and both Mr. Wells and myself were asked to contribute. I was to do a series of horror stories. And it says in the review, "This obscure episode in late Victorian publishing history is intriguing for a number of reasons. It would be interesting to know, for instance, just how Ravenhill and Girdlestone phrased their offer. Perhaps they requested more stuff in the pan line? Writing in the 1920s, Macken speaks of horror stories and tales of horror, but it's unlikely that these were the expressions used at the time. This was, after all, precisely the period during which the still fluid conceptual boundaries of emergent genre categories like science fiction, fantasy, and horror were beginning to be negotiated, shaped, and defined." It says, "The more tantalizing question is, if The Unicorn and its editor scheme had been a success, would have Macken's reputation been more like Wells's? Triumph after triumph, as well as worldwide celebrity. Macken's career was sort of a roller coaster, and it kind of went downhill from here at this point."
Yeah.
Interesting. That could have been a little early, you know, Weird Tales before Weird Tales.
It could have been, yeah.
In the 1890s, but it folded. Now, I read this story, as I have most of the Arthur Macken we've covered, in my hardback copy of The Great God Pan and Other Weird Stories from Arcane Wisdom Press from 2009. You and I were lucky enough to get copies of that. It has an intro and notes from S.T. Joshi. Beautiful book, but I am afraid I have to point out a hilarious error. To be honest, I was having a hard time sitting down to read this. It was a hectic week. I'd reserved some time in the morning yesterday. It was a really nice day, though, so I was getting easily distracted. So finally get all the distractions out of the way. I get myself settled, got some tea, crack open the book, and there's the title, The Shining Pyramid.
What?
They use 2 N's in the title.
Oh, no.
Right there over the story. Big, bold letters. You know, right around Halloween, I'd been discussing, what are the best Simpsons treehouses of horror? And I remembered the best one was the one that had The Shining, which was their parody of The Shining. So I'm laughing at the typo and I think, well, I better go back and actually watch that episode since it's been referenced in this story. Mm-hmm. You know, like it's for work. So I put the book down, found the episode. It's Treehouse of Horror 5 from the 6th season. It's one of the best Simpsons episodes ever. So funny. Oh. I watched the whole thing and I recommend a revisit.
Well, there you go. That sounds like a great way to not work.
That's what it was.
Good job.
But now I've told you about it on the show. So technically...
Oh, there you go. Hey, you know, actually, I was playing some Oculus Quest 2, mm-hmm. this game called Unchained, where you're in heaven and hell and purgatory, and you got a bow and an arrow. It's really cool. And that was for work as well.
Wait a minute. I think we've unlocked a strategy here, Lackey.
Yeah, and I also for 3 hours watching...
Whoa. All right, maybe. All right, I'm ending this strategy right now. That is not...
No, that isn't...
No, let's...
Well, this story, The Shining Pyramid, begins with these two men, Dyson and Vaughn. Dyson is Mackin's occult detective character that he uses in a few of his other stories.
Three short stories and the longer narrative, The Three Imposters. Way back when we covered The Red Hand and the novel of The Black Seal in 2013, yep. we did 4 episodes there, so probably lots of Dyson we talked about. More recently, in 2019, we did the novel of The White Powder, which also has Dyson, so a lot of Dyson when you're subscribed to this podcast. If you recall this character, he's not a professional detective. He's a gentleman with a keen interest in mysterious events.
Yeah.
He investigates strange deaths and disappearances and encounters weird beings and secret orders.
But he's detecting them.
Yes.
So he is a detective.
He's the dude that's got information.
Vaughn has gotten into London. He's been out of town and he wants Dyson to come with him out to the West Country.
He's got a place there. Vaughn describes himself as a hermit. I've done nothing but loaf about, which he says in response to the inquiry about, does he have a wife? He's like, I'm too lazy. So Vaughn is asking him to come out for a few days to the rural West. Again, this is people in the story who can sort of take off and go hang out with each other for a while.
Yeah.
People of means.
Yeah.
But Dyson is resistant because he really likes the city at this time of year.
Vaughn explains that while he was away at his place in the West, there was an odd occurrence. A young woman disappeared. She went off one afternoon to visit her aunt, and no one ever saw her again. The houses are only 5 or 6 miles apart, and there wasn't anything of any danger between the two.
And Dyson asks some pretty reasonable questions. Were there any disused mines in the area that she might have fallen into or cliffs that she could have tumbled over? But there really isn't anything like that.
And Dyson asks what the locals think might have happened to her. And Vaughn says, they're as bad as the Irish, every whit, and even more secretive. They think it's the supernatural.
The poor girl is supposed to have, quote, gone with the fairies or to have been, quote, taken by the fairies.
So fairies gets Dyson interested. The police, however, they think that the girl, her name's Annie Trevor, had fallen in with a rough crowd of sailors from a port that wasn't too far away, but no one saw any strangers around town, so that seems like a bit of a stretch.
Now, pausing for a little xenophobia here in the description of this port and who these sailors are, it seems important to the horror of the story. It says, Castletown is a large seaport, you know, and some of the worst of the foreign sailors occasionally desert their ships and go on a tramp up and down the country. Not many years ago, a Spanish sailor named Garcia murdered a whole family for the sake of plunder that was not worth sixpence. They are hardly human, some of these fellows, and I am dreadfully afraid the poor girl must have come to an awful end. I mean, no doubt there's probably some jerks that show up out of these ports and do some stealing and thieving mm-hmm. and that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's very important that this is a foreigner. But no foreign sailor was seen by anybody recently, so they definitely would have noticed as well because it's a homogenous group in this town. The hardly human phrase, this was from Vaughn, who's not the mystic. He means it in a sort of xenophobic way.
Yeah.
He's just disgusted by foreigners. I feel like that sort of fear of the other civilization or the uncivilized old civilization, it's kind of what this story is about. This is the germ that grows into that type of thing in Lovecraft's work as well.
Mm-hmm. Vaughn explains that this tale about this missing girl is only a tangent. This event that happened with this girl, this was a month ago, but something has happened to him personally in the last few days. Vaughn explains that near his house, there is a path that the locals use a bit, but it's not heavily trafficked. When he was out walking it, he noticed that near a wall, there was a bunch of flints arranged in a pattern on the ground. And Vaughn draws a picture to show Dyson.
12 little stones neatly arranged in lines and spaced at equal distances. They were pointed stones and the points were very carefully directed one way. So an odd bit of symbology, We see this a lot in folk horror, where there'll be something, you know, some kind of thing that's laying around, and you know that it means something, but you don't know what the meaning is.
Yes.
When it's in Mackin, it always, this kind of reminds me of George R.R. Martin. The way he introduces the White Walkers and the horror of them is with the arcane symbology. They arrange their bodies in something. You don't know what it means, but it's scary because
right.
of that.
Dyson points out that it could have been children, which do live around in the area. The next day, he went to see if they were still there, but this time they were arranged in a different pattern, something like the spokes of a wheel. And Dyson sticks to his child theory, but Vaughn points out that the kids only go that way on their way to school. This happened during the night. So the next day, he found them in the shape of a pyramid. And then he decided to hang out and watch the kids as they came by on their way to school. And they didn't even stop to look at this thing or notice it. Obviously, they didn't do it because they didn't even see it.
They do, however, notice the man standing by the wall watching them.
Why don't you play, children? Let me watch what you do when you play.
Dude, that didn't seem perverse. That just seemed to seem real sad.
Yeah, you're right.
He didn't seem like a creep. He just sounded like a guy that was has like lost touch with his ability to find joy in life. And he was hoping that if those kids play, that maybe he'll find it again.
Yeah, it's the that's exactly what was going on in that performance, Craig. I feel really seen.
I understand. He sees a succession of forms laid out day after day. Lines, spokes, and a bowl, a pyramid, and lastly, a half moon. Vaughn says that he has objects in his home that match these shapes. Specifically, he's got a punch bowl in his house. And he thinks that maybe the burglars want his punch bowl and they're messing with him.
Some weird reasoning. And you can sort of tell that it amuses Dyson as well. That he's like, that's a dumb theory, but he's too polite to make fun of him.
Yeah.
Because the theory is, so you think some burglars arranged these things in the shape of the valuable they want to steal and pointed it in that direction to let some other burglars know, or because they didn't want them to get lost and maybe rob the trees? I don't think there's anywhere else here where valuables would be held.
It's pretty crazy. Dyson also notes that it's odd that the stone used is flint, not the local sandstone. Vaughn has brought one of these flints, and Dyson recognizes it as an ancient arrowhead. And he tells Vaughn that they're going to go to the country to investigate this immediately.
I hardly think they can harbor any designs on your punch bowl. This arrowhead isn't just ancient, by the way. He says it is of vast antiquity, which is much scarier. And not only that, but an arrowhead of a unique kind. He doesn't say what that is, but there's something about it that's got him pretty excited.
Yeah.
We're so used to this stuff and also so out of the era in which this was written, it's hard to get the emotional impact. But again, if you think about some antique stones arranged in the middle of the night in weird shapes out by the patio, it's pretty scary.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is stuff, you know, like in that story Sticks, and we talked about it in the Blair Witch Project, where there's these ancient things. There's intent behind them, but we just don't understand what that intent is, and that's creepy.
And then we get into chapter two, The Eyes on the Wall.
Now, at the site of the stone shapes, Dyson notices a stream nearby, and that there's a huge piece of limestone coming out of the grass by a wall. And this wall has a deep red mark that looks like an eye carved into it. The eye is said to look like that of a Chinaman's. Dyson says that it would be odd for a kid to make this eye. Yeah, why would a kid make an East Asian eye, I guess is what he's saying, instead of an Anglo eye. And it's also lower to the ground at a child's height.
I should like very much, he said at length, to know how a child in this out-of-the-way place could have any idea of the shape of the Mongolian eye. You see, the average child has a very distinct impression on the subject. He draws a circle, or something like a circle, puts a dot in the center. I don't think any child imagines that the eye is really made like that. It's just a convention of infantile art. But this almond-shaped thing puzzles me extremely. Perhaps it may be derived from a gilt Chinaman on a tea canister in the grocer's shop. Still, that's hardly likely. I was like, or maybe somebody drew a fish? I mean, they're really going down. They just decided it's an eye. Then they're just exploring that notion as if it were based on any kind of data. It's just not.
Well, and also, if you draw a very simple eye, how the hell are you able to tell the difference between an Anglo eye and an East Asian eye if it's, like, iconic? Like, eyes aren't that different.
This stuff is so hard for me to take seriously. I know this guy's supposed to be a master of the genre and stuff, but I'm reading this just going, what?
Yeah.
Because I'm a bad artist. So the eyes in my drawings when I was a kid were all over the place. Could have been a square or a triangle. Who knows?
Yeah.
But even the idea that it's a child, because what they're describing sounds to me like somebody drew a fish. Uh-huh. Like, it's an almond shape with a dot in the middle of it. And maybe they did it low to the ground because it's a fish. That's where they are.
Or whoever drew it was nailing.
Exactly. But no, they're like, well, the whole idea of the children thing, the whole reason they're circling it in, other than trying to see somebody experience joy, is because they want to point out that these are drawn close to the ground. So if it wasn't a child, what diminutive thing is doing this?
Yeah, that's where he's going with this. Dyson doesn't believe that this is the work of burglars, then asks if there's any local gypsies, because we got to offend everybody with this story. But Vaughn says that there are none around.
I think that probably there's some Romani listeners right now that are like, don't worry about it. I'm not that upset.
I hope so. The next morning, they find another eye carved in the wall. Dyson deduces this must have been done at night, and whoever did it must be able to see well at night, as the trees would shade the moonlight. But then I thought to myself, could they just have a lantern or something? Maybe a torch?
Bring their own light? I thought the same thing. Also, maybe the child was trying to draw that perfectly circular eye, but it was dark. If these two ever came to Los Angeles, their minds would be completely blown because there's spray paint tagging all over the place.
Oh, yeah.
It goes up, it comes down, it's all got meaning. Totally indecipherable. I don't know what it is. If it's just signing a place or if it means this is territory, don't come here. I mean, I think those two'd be really surprised that they were in California in 2021.
Sure.
But like the third day, they'd be, what is with this tagging?
Vaughn, you see this eye on this bridge? It must have been drawn by a 30-foot tall man. It's ridiculous. That gets us into the third chapter, the search for the ball.
So they're out for a walk in the neighborhood.
Dyson and Vaughn pass by Trevor, and he's the grief-stricken father of the missing girl, Annie.
This prompts Dyson to inquire, I recollect now. To tell the truth, I'd forgotten all about it. Nothing's been heard of the girl? Nothing whatever. The police are quite at fault. So he just completely forgot that this had happened. He's so interested in the eye stuff.
Dyson wonders if these things are connected. Of course they are. And asks Vaughn where they think the girl was last seen.
Turns out she was headed up into the hills.
Mm-hmm. They go back to the house and Dyson explains that he's got a lot of work to do tomorrow and he wants to find that bowl. Vaughn brings up his punch bowl again, saying, "Hell, no, the bowl's fine. It's in the cabinet. Don't worry about it." Is this an attempt at humor in the story? Is that what's going on?
Well, I think, sort of like you intuited earlier, it's showing that Vaughn has lost joy in his life. Because that punch bowl, why is it in a cabinet instead of out for parties?
Exactly.
You know, I think that there's a really sad story about Vaughn just under the surface here.
So the next day, he follows the path that Annie took and finds a recessed area that looks like the remains of an old Roman amphitheater. The ugly crags of limestone rimmed it round as if with a broken wall. Basically, he finds that the shape is like that of a bowl, and then he returns back home. So he thinks that this place is the bowl. And he tells Vaughn that they now have 6 days of waiting around.
Because they found this big bowl shape. You know, I didn't get it the first time. We're going to find out I didn't get a whole lot of things. But on the reread, because earlier when he was talking about the symbols, it happened 4 times and then it stopped. And the first symbol were what we described earlier, arranged, all pointing in one direction. And that's what they're calling the army. The spoke-like symbol and the next one they call the bowl. Mm-hmm. After that, it was a pyramid, which they're calling the pyramid, and then a half moon. And then I realized, oh, this is what it is. That army symbol was likely a call, you know, to some sort of group. The bowl seems to be the location.
Yes.
So Dyson thinks the bowl is discovered, but where is the pyramid?
And the half moon, because they've got to wait a few days, is the time.
That's what the waiting is about. I didn't get that right away. I was like, why is he waiting 6 days? On my reread, that's when it clicked. But no idea what the shining pyramid is if it's not the Luxor.
No.
I suppose all will be revealed in Chapter 4, The Secret of the Pyramid.
One night, Dyson takes Vaughn out on a walk around 9 p.m. He believes he knows what's going on, but he's not sharing it with Vaughn yet. They take the path that Annie, Trevor took, and then they get to this place.
They came out at last on the steep hillside, and instead of the oppression of the wood, there was the long, dim sweep of the turf, and higher, the fantastic limestone rocks hinted horror through the darkness. And the wind sighed as it passed across the mountain to the sea, and in its passage beat chill about their hearts.
Dyson says to wait and lie down, so they hide, basically. Vaughn recognizes this is the area that the locals are afraid to go to. Supposed to be a fairy's castle, he says. Dyson tells him to keep his voice down, and then he says, "You see this hollow before us is the bowl." And then they lie quiet for a while.
For a long while. And Vaughn is getting really impatient, as I imagine I would as well, because if my friend was like, I'm not going to tell you anything, let's just climb up on a hill and lay around quietly in the dark for a few hours. Wait a minute, maybe this is a rom-com.
Finally, they hear a noise from the bowl, a strident and horrible hissing. Then Dyson takes a look.
It did, in truth, stir and seethe like an infernal cauldron. The whole of the sides and bottom tossed and writhed, with vague and restless forms that passed to and fro without the sound of feet, and gathered thick here and there and seemed to speak to one another in those tones of horrible sibilance, like the hissing of snakes that he had heard. It was as if the sweet turf and the cleanly earth had suddenly become quickened with some foul writhing growth. Vaughn could not draw back his face, though he felt Dyson's finger touch him, but he peered into the quaking mass and saw faintly that there were things like faces and human limbs. And yet he felt his inmost soul chill with the sure belief that no fellow soul or human thing stirred in all that tossing and hissing host. He looked aghast, choking back sobs of horror, and at length the loathsome forms gathered thickest about some vague object in the middle of the hollow, and the hissing of their speech grew more venomous, and he saw in the uncertain light the abominable limbs, vague and yet too plainly seen, writhe and intertwine, and he thought he heard, very faint, a low human moan striking through the noise of speech that was not of man. At his heart, something seemed to whisper ever, worm corruption, the worm that dieth not. And grotesquely, the image was pictured to his imagination of a piece of putrid offal stirring through and through with bloated and horrible creeping things. The writhing of the dusky limbs continued. They seemed clustered round the dark form in the middle of the hollow, and the sweat dripped and poured off Vaughn's forehead and fell cold on his hand beneath his face.
Well, that was pretty darn creepy.
Yeah, pretty creepy. Now, they can see a human form left behind, moving and screaming as these creatures move away, and we presume it's Annie. Then a great pyramid of flame shot up, and the whole area is lit.
In that instant, Vaughn saw the myriads beneath, the things made in the form of men but stunted like children, hideously deformed, the faces with the almond eyes burning with evil and unspeakable lusts, the ghastly yellow of the mass of naked flesh, and then, as if by magic, the place was empty, while the fire roared and crackled, and the flames shone abroad. "You've seen the pyramid," said Dyson in his ear. "The Pyramid of Fire."
And that's the end of the story.
What? No, it's not.
Exactly. Okay, so I'm making fun of this book earlier. Uh-huh. I'm reading this yesterday, and there's a big panel, a picture in the next page.
Uh-huh.
And so I thought this story was over. I thought that was the end of it. I went, man. So that's the Pyramid of Fire, and that's all they're going to give you. That's a pretty bold ending, actually. I like it. And so I only was finding out as I was doing notes, wait a minute, there's a fifth chapter? Oh, no. I mean, literally 5 minutes before we jumped on to record this, I thought, is it a difference in the revisions? And I looked in the book and realized I just didn't read the fifth chapter. So now I'm in with the listeners. I did my own shinning on that one. Can't blame the book. That was my fault. Chris, what happens in the thrilling conclusion of this story?
Oh, boy. So the next day, Dyson shows a brooch to Vaughn, and he says there was Annie. And Vaughn asks if he found Annie, and Dyson says, dude, you saw what I saw last night. You know I didn't find her. Vaughn says that it must have been some kind of delusion since the marks on the wall are gone. It's all over. Dyson says, I have to tell you what happened, or at least what I think happened. Basically, I have to explain everything that we just saw.
So this is just a big explanation of what happened.
Yeah, even though
this chapter,
we don't really need an explanation. It just told us everything. And when you said you thought that was what happened in the story there, that was the ending, it would have been a much better ending. But then we have a whole chapter of just filling in on some details that we don't really need.
Just saying that the townspeople, I'm scanning in here, it looks like Oh, man, people who are Arthur Macken fans are going to be so mad at me. But I'm reading this right now, and it looks like basically what he's doing is connecting it all to the fairy legends.
Yeah. He goes into detail. He explains that he found this brooch, Annie's brooch, in a pile of ashes at the bowl. Dyson says the bowl laid out the miniature one was a message to the secret society of the subterranean little people.
Okay, so what I figured out.
Yeah, basically what we said earlier, what we figured out. He's got to tell.
So if I figured it out, that's such a better.
Yeah. And so he's telling everything. And he says that the lore surrounding fairies represents a tradition of prehistoric Turanian inhabitants of the country who were cave dwellers. The place near Vaughn's house might have been a meeting place for those creatures since long, long ago. And then he wraps it up with this.
I think I need say very little more. You know, we were quite helpless, even if we had foreseen what was to come. I don't regret our inability to rescue the wretched girl. You saw the appearance of those things that gathered thick and writhed in the bowl. You may be sure that what lay bound in the midst of them was no longer fit for Earth. So? Said Vaughn. So she passed in the Pyramid of Fire, said Dawson. And they passed again to the underworld, to the places beneath the hills.
And that's the end of the story.
So not really more illumination than what I had already figured out, because it doesn't tell you exactly when it happened.
No,
it's kind of some speculation. But he is connecting this to, as some of the other stories we've covered have, to actual sort of literal creatures. Mm-hmm. Worms of the earth, like in Robert E. Howard.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
These aren't necessarily fairies that are in a parallel fairyland, but
no.
Evil hobbits.
Yeah, evil hobbits.
From a prehistoric society.
Like we were talking about, that was the whole thing with Tolkien. This idea of these evil underground people, these prehistoric, were terrible, and they lived in these gross holes in the ground, and they're subterranean, and then Tolkien flipped it and said, you know what?
Right.
They actually do live underground, but they live in these really nice houses. These hobbit holes are great, and they're really friendly, and they're really easygoing people, and they like to eat. I mean, we've talked about this before, but that was an interesting idea to twist it.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, it's also relating to another maybe foreign entity rather than assuming that there's something subhuman about them because they're not quote unquote civilized,
yeah.
You know, which I think is so infused into this and a lot of writing of the era, that idea that these prehistoric things didn't change. There's no evolution.
Yeah.
They're the de-evolved versions of humans. They're still around.
Yeah.
And on some levels that works because it's, you know, I'm just thinking about the era when people would have been debating Darwinism and evolution.
Yeah.
And you know, these are big ideas that are freaking people out and traditionalists are struggling with them. And the idea that we're related to beasts is very hard to cope with.
Mm.
And that's what a lot of this anxiety is. And relating the foreigners again to they're no more than beasts. It has a lot to do with the person with a soul and language. Language plays into this a lot too,
yeah.
Right? It's... They were hissing. They were communicating something. They can write.
Mm-hmm.
That's threatening.
Sure.
They're using this primitive sort of hieroglyphic writing to communicate with one another. And that shows a non-animal intelligence. And that's scary because they're supposed to be the animals. It's got a very, I don't know, maybe the reason that I don't like it a little bit is because I don't have those sort of ideas in my heart of supremacy.
Of course. Yeah.
Over the animal world, I'm saying.
Well, that's the thing about evolution. Evolution happens to adapt to your environment. And if these things didn't evolve, that's because they function. They don't need to evolve. Like sharks. Sharks have been around for, you know, hundreds of millions of years because they work.
Yeah.
They don't need to evolve. There's no better version of a shark because the shark is the perfect thing.
But yeah, exactly. Sharks, they don't need to evolve because they're doing really well in the environment that they're in.
And that's the same thing with orangutans or other primates. They work for their environment. And it was our ancestors that were trying to adapt to different environments that were able to evolve and change.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the ones that were more clever were the ones that survived better because they were able to adapt faster. These things are badass, actually, because they haven't evolved. They're perfectly suited to their environment.
They're perfectly suited to the environment, and they're smarter than we were all thinking they were. And maybe they're not always going to stay hidden. I think that anxiety of... that we all know. And this isn't just part of imperialistic or Western culture. I mean, everybody moves into a place that somebody else lived in at some point. So
oh, yeah.
the way that he's saying these are You know, these are folks that were here before the Etruscans were here. You know, this is the old civilization of England. It's almost like a poltergeist. The anxiety that's in there that we built this house over the Indian burial ground.
Mm-hmm.
That those people who really own the place are going to show up and want the place back at some point.
Yeah.
It plays into that teeny bit of guilt that I think everybody carries around with them, knowing that they're living in a place that they took.
Yeah.
Or that their people took. Yeah. I see in here maybe a little bit as well.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about. It's not a particularly great story. There's some really neat, like, you know, that one bit that we had read. That was the apex of creepiness to it. But, we've had better.
Yeah, I mean, I've been liking most of the stories this month. And this topic folks are really into, actually. So we thought that for our bonus episode, we were going to do something different. But let's talk more about scary fairies and the fae. Because in doing these stories, we've just kind of danced around it a little bit. I like to get to some actual legends about what these creatures are and what they can do to people. And some of the stuff that folks who were writing these things probably would have known about. So for our bonus episode this month, we're just going to talk about the fae in general and how they can get you.
They can get you.
Which is exciting. That'll be on the last day of the month. I want to thank George Woodruff for reading for us.
So good. Thank you so much. And if you have any audio needs, if you like the way he sounded and you want him to sound that way for your stuff, get in touch with him.
Yeah, give him a little tickle.
You'll find his contact info in the show notes.
You will. And I also want to thank some patrons.
Yes. I'd like to thank Courtney Anderson.
I'd like to thank Sean Colbath.
I'd like to thank Comic Book Dungeon Podcast.
I'd like to thank Eric W. Mertz.
I'd like to thank Lebahan C. Borgerson.
Nancy J. Geese.
Matteo Maverna, thank you.
Introvert, thank you.
Richard Angstrom, thank you.
And finally, Lazy Elvis, thank you.
He's not so lazy. He, you know, supports our show, so.
That's true. But when you've had a career like Elvis Presley or Costello, be lazy. You can rest on your laurels a bit.
Yeah.
Actually, you know, hearing that, it's kind of interesting considering what we've been covering this month. Elvis?
Mm-hmm.
Elvish?
Whoa.
Was Elvis Presley a fairy?
Yes. And with that, I'm Chris Lackey.
I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And you've been listening to Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
Exclusively on Patreon.
HPPodcraft.com.